Mr. Hensenry, where were you born, please?
I was born in Rhodesia, as it was then called.
Which year was this?
That was the 2nd of September 1931.
Whereabouts in Rhodesia were you born?
At a place called Fort Victoria.
Was your father a farmer there?
He was a mining engineer with copper and wolfram and all the other minerals, and then he retired and farmed, tobacco farmed.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Rhodesia?
I grew up, but I came over just before the outbreak of war and never got back, because clearly after the outbreak of war it was impossible to do so. And I continued and went to school in England and to the university and finished my education here.
Where did you go to university?
Oxford.
Which college was
that? Lincoln College. Hmm.
Did the war affect you at all?
Yes, I suppose it did. Principally because the opportunities that people today have just did not exist. And education itself suffered incredibly. The people who would have been teaching us were all away fighting, with the result that frequently we had young students who perhaps were teaching a completely unrelated discipline to the one that they themselves were studying. In other words, medical students might be teaching you French, that kind of thing. And so I would think the quality of our prep school education undoubtedly suffered. If you were lucky enough to have masters who were too old to fight, then probably that was okay. But most of the ones of a prep school age, or teaching prep school children, are normally quite young. So off they went.
Any other effects that it had on you?
Off the cuff, I can't think of many, but...
You didn't experience any bombing by the German Air Force?
Oh, yes. We were down in Kent, and we were just south of Biggin Hill Airfield. And every night, we had bombers coming over. We, in fact, saw the very first doodlebug. We had an anti-aircraft gun in the grounds, and there were barrage balloons everywhere. And every night, we used to go down into the cellars of this large building, and we'd hear the unsynchronized drone of the German bombers going across. And then occasionally, one or two would get shot down, and we'd all scramble like mad to go and pick up souvenirs, bits of metal and bits of this and that.
What was the name of the village that you were in?
It was Otford, O-T-F-O-R-D, near Sevenoaks.
Did any bombs actually land in Otford?
Oh, yes. The day I went to the school, and my mother took me there, the air raid siren went. We all went down into the shelter, which is in the middle of Otford Green. And when we popped up, there was a huge crater. And we saw quite a lot of the Blitz. And we were on the main run between London and the French coast. Hence the first doodlebugs and the V2s, when the V2s occurred. We were sitting in a classroom. The master had put the blackboard temporarily against a pair of double doors while he was doing something else. And without a sound, both these doors opened. The plate glass window split from one corner to the other, and only then do we hear the explosion. And we looked across several fields, and we saw this enormous trail of smoke and the dust rising from the explosion. Well, and that was a V2.
Were there many casualties in the village?
Not that I was aware of.
How frightening was it for you as a schoolboy?
We loved it. We loved it. And we watched dogfights taking place, literally over our heads. We were told to get undercover, but we didn't care. We loved it. And we even saw the Tempest aircraft, which had a slightly slower speed than the V-1. We saw these Tempests climb into the sky, and in order to gain enough momentum and acceleration, they had to dive on top of these V-1s, and a burst of cannon fire would tilt the wing of the V-1, and the thing would steer towards the ground, and up it would go. It's amazing how you can remember every detail.
Any celebrations at the end of the war you remember?
Yes, certainly. We were in Hyde Park, excuse me, and we went off to Buckingham Palace, and we saw the royal party on the balcony, and the place was just a heaving mass of people. You couldn't hear yourself think, but we certainly watched that.
So can you tell me how you came to be in the army after the war, please?
I was called up as a national serviceman. And that was it. And I went to before the War Office Selection Board at, was it Barton Stacey? I think it was Barton Stacey. And got selected for a commission, and I went to Eton Hall, the officer cadet training school, and they said, what regiment do you want to go into? And having been at my public school in Suffolk, I said, okay, I'll go into any East Anglian regiment. And they were making up the numbers of the Royal Norfolk Regiment at that time. And so I, and I think about six of us from the same intake at Eton Hall, all went into the Royal Norfolk together. And shortly after that, well, we did our basic training at Thetford Camp in Norfolk. And then we all got onto a trooper, and away we went to Korea.
What impression did the training make on you?
I think it was very good. I think the army is one of the most marvelous institutions because it took us a whole lot of ragtag and bobtail and clothed us, fed us, disciplined us, worked us very hard. We trained, we physically were extremely fit, and I think that sort of training set us up very well for going out to Korea.
Did you have any problems with the training?
Not that I can recollect. The thing that I do rather regret is that there we all were on the firing ranges with no ear defense whatsoever. And of course, I'm now deaf in one ear. And this is a very common thing.
What was the troopship voyage like?
All right, quite an adventure. And we went right through Gibraltar, the Red Sea, all the rest of it. And it was fine. We trained on board, elementary sort of rifle training, throwing tin cans over the side and taking pot shots at them. I remember doing our physical training in the well of the lift, the ship's lift, and the lift was sent up, and we used this small rectangle in which to do our PT and all the rest of it. Bit limiting. And we did route marches. We went on a route march when we got to Colombo, and I remember somebody dropped down dead with a heart attack because the heat was colossal and we weren't used to it. And then we arrived in Korea, and we were met by an American Negro band playing jazz, which was really quite good. And then we had something like, I suppose, a 9-hour slow train journey from Pusan up to the front line.
Had you had, on the way to Korea, any briefing about the war?
Not much. We didn't really understand the political implications of the whole thing at all. Very few of us did, I would say.
Any warnings that you got on the troop ship about what to do and what not to do?
I don't think so, because it was assumed that our basic training, infantry training, would take care of most contingencies, which it did. And we had experienced officers, company commanders, majors, battalion commanders, and so on, who themselves had been in the Second World War, which wasn't so long ago. And so we profited from their experience.
What was the train journey from Pusan northwards like?
Pretty dreadful. Wooden, slatted seats, and very, very slow, and we just chunted slowly through. And there were a lot of Americans on the same train. I remember being quite surprised when I opened a compartment door and I saw 8 full colonels of the United States Army all sitting together in one compartment. Whereas, of course, in our way, each platoon commander looks after his own platoon. But there they were, and I was a bit astonished at that, really.
About what date was this, approximately?
It was, excuse me, it was September 1950.
1950?
Is that right? Yes, 50. That's when we landed.
Right at the beginning of the Korean War?
Yes, yes. It had been, the war had started, I think, in the August, or July, I forget exactly.
Possibly June.
Maybe June, I don't know, well, I wasn't there. But we landed in September, October.
So what happened at the end of the train journey?
We were put into a camp, which had been prepared for us by the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers, and they called it Britannia Camp. And that was, of course, the Royal Norfolk's badge. And they called it Britannia Camp, and we moved in, and we stayed there for a while before moving up to the front line.
What were you doing at Britannia Camp?
We were training, probably given lectures. In fact, I remember one from one of the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders people, who'd actually been behind the enemy lines because the enemy overran his front line. And he managed to escape. He turned round and came out again. And he told us what the conditions were like.
Do you remember what he said?
Very little. Not really.
What job had you been given in the battalion?
I was a platoon commander.
Do you remember which platoon and which company?
Oh, yes. It was C Company, Charlie Company, and my platoon was 9 Platoon.
What did your job involve?
Patrolling. We probably did a fighting patrol or reconnaissance patrol every 3 or 4 nights. And this was going on right across the front. At that point, the front was fairly static. The Chinese had, in fact, pursued the Americans right down to a small bridgehead near Pusan, and then the tide turned and they went back again after the landings on the east coast at Incheon. And thereafter, the line held along the 38th parallel. 39th parallel.
38th
parallel. And so we dug in and prepared for whatever. But it was a question of patrolling the whole time. And it became rather degraded at times. You know, crate of beer for the first platoon to capture a prisoner, that kind of thing. But anyway, that's the army.
Did you capture a prisoner?
Yes, we did.
Can you describe what happened?
Well, he gave himself up, if you like. It was very, very cold, bitterly cold. And one of the forward sentries reported that there was movement in front of him. And so it was investigated. And there was one Chinese in a white padded quilted suit with basketball boots on his feet. And he had two rifle rounds in his pocket and nothing else. And he gave himself up. And the first thing my company commander, Hubert Holden, said was, "Have a drink, old boy."
What, he offered the Chinese a drink?
Yes.
Did he accept?
Yes, I think he did. He was bitterly cold. Anyway, we shoveled him off and he went back to rear echelon for interrogation.
Did he appear to be wounded or sick?
No. He was actually with an anti-aircraft division. And I don't know how he got across our lines, but anyway, he wandered across no man's land, which then was about 2.5 to 3 miles across, and across the Samichon River, which he'd had to ford because the bridge had been blown. Anyway, he made it.
What type of clothes was he dressed in?
Well, he was just wearing one of these quilted suits, a white one, because it was snow camouflage. And I think he had frostbite, as far as I recall.
Can you describe how you carried out the patrols, please?
We'd have a briefing the night before. We'd be given all the code words for bringing in anti-aircraft fire, or normally MMG fire, or 25-pounder fire in our support. And after the briefing, I would then brief my people. And they'd each be assigned a task, you know, who's going to be in the Bren, on the Bren, what formation you patrol in, who's going to be on the left, who's on the right. And so we knew our positions before darkness fell, and we were able to proceed, whether it was a fighting patrol, a reconnaissance patrol, or whatever. And we'd be given, obviously, passwords, and we'd know what time we were going out, what time we were coming back. And this went on constantly right across the 29 Brigade front.
What formation would you normally adopt?
Usually a diamond formation. Possibly with myself either right at the front or number two, and I'd probably have a Bren on my right, another one on my left, if it was a big patrol. If it were a fighting patrol, I'd have probably a couple of Brens. And stop, look, and listen. And I always took binoculars at night. The light-gathering power of a pair of binoculars, even at night, means that you can actually see quite a lot that you wouldn't be able to see if you didn't take them. So I always did that, and it was very, very good, very handy.
What other equipment would you personally take?
We inherited a lot of equipment in the way of small arms from the Americans. And I used to have a carbine, M1 carbine, which is a most wonderful weapon, far more accurate than the Sten, longer range than the Sten, not as heavy as the 303, and of course it was an automatic. The magazine held 15 rounds, and we used to tape two magazines together, reversed, so that you could, if you ran through 15 rounds, you turn the thing upside down, and you got another 15 rounds. And it was a damn good weapon, very, very good. And the normal drill would be that each of the patrol would carry two bandoliers of rifle ammunition. He might carry a Sten, he might carry a rifle. You'd probably have four grenades per man. What else? I think that's about it. I would probably carry a Very pistol, which would be used either for illumination with a star shell or star cartridge, or maybe for signaling, green, red, whatever. And the Bren, of course, number one and number two on the Bren would also carry the ammunition, and you needed some big lads for that. And usually you'd make sure that your Bren was a six-footer and strong.
What kind of grenades were there?
They were the old Mills grenade, the 3.8 grenades, which actually were the same as the ones in the war, in the First World War and Second World War. Hadn't changed. We didn't use any other type. The Chinese used percussion grenades and the tatty masher grenade like the Germans had, with a handle. Pull a ring to arm it and hurl it. Yep.
Did you have any problems with the passwords and getting back safely?
No. There were problems. I personally didn't have any. But there were problems. Yeah. And that's the way accidents happen.
Would you go right up to enemy lines?
Oh, yes. Your reconnaissance would... Well, I've done reconnaissances across the river into villages which were clearly occupied, and you just had to make sure you're quite quiet about it and then come home. Inflatable rubber boat, one man rowing, me sitting in it, and that was a little reconnaissance patrol we once did.
Were you ever under orders to snatch anybody?
Yes. Yes.
Did it come off?
The one that I took out resulted in... Well, we ambushed them and there was a firefight. And the opportunities for snatching were not exactly there. We took back quite a few wounded Chinese. And we managed to extricate ourselves out of that. But they always said it shouldn't have been a 13-man patrol.
What should it be? Because of an unlucky number?
Yep.
How were the wounded Chinese carried?
Well, we brought back, I think it was four or five, because when we were completely surrounded and pretty well... Well, we were in very bad straits. And so I radioed for assistance. And another company came out into No Man's Land and managed to beat off the Chinese. And eventually, we all got back home.
Did you suffer many casualties yourselves?
Yes.
From patrolling?
Well, yes, we did. In that particular patrol, we lost... I think it was four. I've got the details there. Yeah, we lost three or four killed, and I think it was another four wounded. It was a 13-man patrol, and eight of us were not capable of returning back. So, you know, it left just... 8 from 13, that was it.
So you were wounded yourself?
No, I wasn't. No.
What happened to the dead and wounded?
Well, they were taken back, first to company headquarters and then back to rear echelon. And the Chinese wounded were interrogated. And our own wounded were sent back to hospital in Japan. And then, poor fellows, if they still had time to do, they had to come out again And once you've been wounded, that's not much fun.
Did you take field dressings out with you?
Yes. Yes, we used field dressings. We had morphine and field dressings, shell dressings. That's about it.
What's the difference between a field dressing and a shell dressing?
Well, shell dressing, we called them shell dressings, a big one, that you could stuff into a hole and stop the bleeding.
Were people happy with the dressings that they took out?
Didn't often have to use them, only once or twice. And I never heard any complaints about them. You know, if you're wounded, I think you're grateful for anything.
How long would you normally stay out for on a patrol?
You'd probably go out at last light, which would be about 6. And you'd come back, unless there was some incident, you might come back at first light, which would be about 4 or 5 in the morning.
Which did you prefer, fighting patrols or recce patrols?
I think with a fighting patrol, there's a chance of something happening. A recce patrol might be just a long vigil and bitterly cold. So, not too exciting.
When you first took over in the line, which regiment did you take over from?
From the Royal Ulster Rifles, who'd been out there for a couple of months. We took over from the Royal Ulster Rifles, who'd been out there in the summer, and they were all brown as brown. They hadn't worn shirts for months. Their hair was halfway down their backs. And they looked a fairly formidable crowd. So I thought, well, we'll get these lads to teach our lads a thing or two. And, of course, they were delighted to do so. So we very quickly put them on to wiring. We were wiring defensive positions. And the Royal Ulster Rifles boys really moved. They knew that the spotlight was on them, and there was a competition to see how many yards of wiring could be completed in a day, and they were absolutely brilliant. Brilliant.
Was there some special technique about wiring?
If you're not really familiar with it, and this is one aspect of our basic training that wasn't covered, but in the field, there are certain tricks of the trade which these boys from the Royal Ulster Rifles had already learnt. And so they were quicker and more efficient with the whole operation. And when you're putting up a double dannet fence with crawl wire in between, you've got to be able to do it quickly and thoroughly. It was good.
How active were the Chinese against you in the line?
They were pretty active. There were, at night, there were vehicle sightings, which usually were made by our forward observation officers. And they could see these vehicles miles behind the lines bringing up troops. And the Chinese used to bring up their labor battalions to dig the trenches at night. And then the labor battalions would retire and the troops would drop into the trenches that had been prepared for them. And they were active, they were patrolling as we were. Their mortars were very good and very accurate. They pinpointed our tanks, and they had an ingenious scheme of drilling a hole through a hillside, and they'd fire a self-propelled armor-piercing shell, self-propelled gun, of course, armor-piercing shells at our tanks. They'd then haul the gun back. You wouldn't see any flash or explosion, and they'd hang a sacking over the hole through which the gun had fired. So they were very, very good at concealment.
What attitude did you develop towards the enemy during your months there?
Well, Well, we didn't like them. We didn't like them. And it's an attitude that dies hard, even today, really.
What made you and your comrades dislike them?
I don't know, they're just alien, oriental, alien, cunning, stealthy, all those sort of attributes.
Were they soldierly?